seated. Good morning. We welcome you all to the Supreme Court and to a new decade, and a good new year to all of you. We have with us today a high school group of students from Monroe High School. Would they please stand? Seeing you all here, and you may be seated. The students are here with a program. Thank you. I'm told that another group of students from Richland Center High School, that's Richland Center is
the hub of the universe and the mecca of the Midwest.
It's her hometown.
Right.
Translate that appropriately. So we want to welcome.
I could.
All right. Before I tell you about the Quote with Class program, we want to welcome the Richland Center High School students. If they would please stand so we can welcome them. Thank you. Both schools are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. And the program invites students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the students agree to come, they give them materials about the case that you're about to hear. And they may engage in various activities that relate to and involve the case. They then come to oral argument. And after the second oral argument, it's about noon, the students will meet with a justice who is assigned for that day to meet with the students. And they talk about the procedures of the court in accepting cases for resolution and how we handle the case. No discussion is made of the substantive issues of the case. And we also have a summary of this case for anyone who would like a summary. Anyone interested in a summary, would you raise your hand? It's easy to understand and hear the case if you know what the facts are and what the legal issues are. Okay. With those introductions made, let me introduce the court. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Justice Ziegler is the justice with whom you will meet, the students will meet at noon after the second case. I say the students, but I really mean anyone who wishes to participate in that meeting. It's open to all of you. Seated next to Justice Ziegler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley of Richland Center High School. No, she didn't go to the high school. You went to a high school? Oh, I didn't know that.
Some thought I skipped high school and went right to college, but indeed I did go to high school.
Well, after this is over, she will sing the school song, but not now. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Brooks. His left, Justice Patience Robensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, we turn to our first case, 07AP2711CR, State versus McGuire. Representing Mr. McGuire is Attorney Robert Hennick. Mr. Hennick, Mr. Hennick, before we proceed, you have made a motion that the oral argument scheduled for today be postponed. awaiting resolution of motions you have relating to disqualification of Justice Gableman. The court issued an order saying that your motion was held in abeyance, and the court has not issued any order taking the case off the oral argument docket. This procedure of proceeding with oral argument after motions on recusal is one that has occurred in the past. And in a prior case this term, namely State versus Patrick Carter, a similar situation arose. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah.
And at that time, to summarize a more lengthy discussion that I had with defense counsel, you will, I'm sure, realize that the discussions said the defendant was faced with two issues. One is that if you didn't appear today as scheduled, it might have been viewed as a waiver or forfeiture of the underlying substantive claims your client has, because you didn't fulfill the obligation to appear, and you might have possibly opened yourself up for a contempt proceeding.
Exactly.
You're aware of that?
Yes.
On the other hand, if you do appear, which you have appeared, and I assume you don't want to waive your substantive claims. Okay. Your client's substantive claims. On the other hand, if you do appear, there's the possibility of your appearance being a forfeiture or waiver of pending motions to disqualify Justice Gableman. Do you want to waive those motions?
No, I do not wish to waive those motions, Your Honor.
So my understanding is you wish to proceed so that you continue claiming the substantive claims you have.
Yes.
The client has, and you also want to continue with your motion for disqualification.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that your appearance here should not be construed as a waiver or forfeiture.
Exactly.
The state and State versus Patrick took no Patrick Carter took no position on whether any your appearance here is a waiver or forfeiture of the motion. You're familiar with that, too.
Yes, I am.
All right. So are we proceeding under the understanding as I've just set forth?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you want to say anything else about
I do not believe that anything else is necessary.
All right. Then we shall proceed. Mr. Hennick, Robert Hennick, counsel for McGuire, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Robert Hennick, and I do represent Donald McGuire on this appeal. The issues, obviously, there are a number of issues that we are raising. Basically, they fall into two groups. First is that due to the 35-year-plus delay in actually charging the case, that the defendant is denied due process, a number of, basically, he's denied the right to a fair opportunity to defend himself. The second group of issues is ineffective assistance of counsel based on trial counsel's failure to conduct what we believe would be a reasonable investigation into exculpatory witnesses. I'd like to focus today on first group of issues because I think that's the novel issues that would have statewide importance. And specifically in those addressing, number one, due process issue, whether this court correctly decided in State v. Wilson the applicable standard for when due process bars a prosecution after a certain period of time that is prejudicial to the defendant. And if we have time, getting into a second issue, which is as applied to this case, whether the tolling provision that allows for tolling of the statute of limitations for time while the defendant is not a public resident of this state is constitutional under the Privileges and Immunities Clauses of the United States Constitution. So first addressing the issue of due process, I would note that the allegations in this case concern incidents that supposedly occurred sometime in 1967 or 1968. They were not reported to the police until the fall of 2003, some 34, 35 years later. Now, under this court's decision in Wilson, the due process standard requires a showing of two things. First, actual prejudice. That is, actual prejudice as opposed to a presumption of prejudice simply from the delay. Second, Wilson requires that the defendant show an improper state motive, such as an intent to delay the charging decision in order to obtain some kind of an advantage over the defendant. Now, my position in this case is that even though the Wilson interpretation of the Supreme Court decisions in this area could be deemed reasonable, in the sense that I have to admit that probably a majority of the courts to assess the issue or to address the issue have held likewise, that the more reasonable interpretation of the Supreme Court decisions in Marion, Lovasco, and Govia, in fact, is a different interpretation, that you do not have to show that there is an intent or an improper state motive to disadvantage the defense.
What do you have to show?
What you do have to show is, again, actual prejudice. And then second, the court has to balance the actual prejudice, the effect on the defense, against the reason that is presented. It can be, for instance, in Marion and Lovasco, the government admitted that if the purpose was a government purpose to disadvantage the defense, then that would be an invalid purpose. The reason would be invalid. You balance the two. But it doesn't have to be that much.
As I looked at Lovasco, it seemed to be a bit more generic as opposed to the Wilson, second prong of the Wilson test, the improper state motive. Is that a correct assessment?
Okay. Exactly. My interpretation of Lovasco, if you look at the first section where they're talking about the standard, what you have to actually show, they discuss Marion. And number one, they address the fact that in Marion, the court held that actual prejudice is necessary but not sufficient for the due process claim. The court then addressed what you have to find for purposes of due process, and the question or the issue in that case came down to whether compelling the respondent to stand trial in this particular case would violate the fundamental conceptions of justice and the community's sense of fair play and decency. So what we do is we balance the actual prejudice to the defense against the reason given for the delay. And you balance that with the general focus, which is the overriding principle of due process, whether there is a fair trial in this case, whether the defendant can obtain a fair trial in this case.
Counselor, do you think that the 2-year delay was inappropriate in this case between the time when the actions were reported to the DA and when charges were filed?
Absolutely not. That delay is not the basis for the motion in this case. The basis for the motion in this case is a 34, 35-year delay before even reporting to the police.
Well, the prosecution really didn't have anything to do with that. My understanding from the case law is you have to show some untoward actions by the prosecution in order to succeed on what you're urging us to do here.
Well, that certainly is the interpretation in Wilson. However, my understanding of Lovasco, let me back up a little bit. Obviously, for a due process violation, there has to be state action at some point. And reading Lovasco, when Lovasco was saying what we have to decide is whether compelling the defendant to stand trial is consistent with the fundamental conceptions of justice. The state action is the court deciding that we are going to proceed with a trial in this case despite the actual prejudice to the defense. Whatever reason it is, whoever we blame for it. In this case, we are not blaming the prosecutor for anything. The prosecutor didn't know anything about this until 2003.
So then you're urging, really what you're doing is making a facial challenge constantly, because if you say that the state action is the court proceeding in compliance with the statute that has a tolling provision, then what you're saying is the court must ignore the tolling provision or find that applying it would be unconstitutional, and I don't see how that's not a facial challenge to the statute, which has already been tried and not upheld.
No, that is not a facial challenge at all. I think the court is confusing.
Isn't the state action, you just said the state action was the court's proceeding to try this man by application of the statute, which had a tolling provision. Otherwise, the statute of limitations would have run on this claim, correct?
Well, yes, without the tolling provision.
That's your position, just so I'm sure I understand your
position.
Well,
it is slightly different than that.
Okay.
There are two separate claims. Number one is that the tolling provision is unconstitutional. What I'm focusing on now is the strict due process argument, that regardless of the tolling provision, even if this was a homicide case and there was no statute of limitations on this, that it would violate due process because actual prejudice, no valid reason for the delay, results in the violation of due process, because compelling the defendant to proceed to trial and to defend himself under these circumstances violates fundamental conceptions of justice.
Why isn't there a valid reason for the delay when the statute provides for such a delay? You see, if you say there's no valid reason for the delay, but the statute gives you the delay, to me, that's a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the statute.
Well, but it isn't, because the due process argument is independent. Under Levasco, under Marion, the due process issue is independent, totally independent of whether or not there even is a statute of limitations. Now, keep in mind that the statute of limitations, also the state legislature has determined, although it doesn't apply in this case under MacArthur, that it is reasonable, and it is only reasonable, to pursue a claim such as this up until the point that the alleged victim reaches the age of 45 years old. So the legislature, in that sense, has made a determination that even when we're talking about a statutory limitations, statute of limitations, that it is not reasonable beyond the defendant or beyond the complainant reaching the age of 45, even when we're only talking about presumptive prejudice. Here, for a due process claim,
I think the legislative history of that statute, Counselor, was to expand what had currently been the statute of limitations prior to that time. I don't think it was meant as any restriction.
Well, it certainly was meant to expand it, because we start off with 21 years old, then 26 years old, I think 35 and 45, and also the legislature for sexual offenses where the victim is under 13, there is no statute of limitations. But I don't think we can say that the legislature intended no limitation, because the legislature put a limitation on there. It's 45 years old.
Well, it depends on what the legislature was trying to do with the statute, Counselor. But there's no need for us to debate that. I'm really more interested in how you're getting around the lack of any untoward conduct by the prosecutor in this case.
And the way that I am getting around it, in the court's terms, is because under Marion, under Levasco, there is no requirement of untoward prosecutorial action. Under those, the question is whether actually pursuing this matter, requiring this man to defend himself in court, is consistent with the fundamental conceptions of due process.
Mr. Hannig?
I'm sorry.
Mr.
I just
Hannig.
Have one more question,
okay.
If I can.
Sure.
So if I understand you, you are saying that Levasco says there does not need to be any untoward action by a prosecutor. Now, is that accurate, or is it just that Levasco did not discuss that aspect?
What Levasco says is two things on that point. Number one is they are not they took the government's concession in that case that this would be a clear violation of due process if the prosecutor intentionally delayed for purposes of disadvantaging the defendant.
Okay.
They specifically said that we are not today deciding the full extent of when delay that results in actual prejudice to the defense violates due process. And third, it held that what we are deciding for issues of due process is whether, that the question is whether, when you balance actual prejudice versus the reasons for the delay, whether requiring this person to proceed to trial violates fundamental conceptions of justice in the particular case.
Right. I understand that part of it, but if I understand what you've just responded to me, Levasco did not deal with or decide the issue that there does not need to be any untoward action by the prosecutor. They simply left that sitting out there based on where the state and the defense decided to focus their arguments. Is that correct?
I think it's probably correct that the court did not specifically decide one way or the other on that.
On that issue.
My argument is that the underlying rationale provided by the court certainly suggests very strongly that that the government misconduct is not the only ground.
Okay, thank you. You've helped me a lot. Thank you very much.
Mr. Hennig, I'd like to put the focus a little bit differently. We look at State versus Wilson, look at Levasco. The first prong is actual prejudice.
Yes.
And when I look at the trial that occurred here, the two people who allegedly had been sexually assaulted by Father McGuire, or Father McGuire was his title, I guess, at the time, basically were there. They testified. They testified under oath. They were subject to cross-examination. Your client was there. Your client certainly had the ability to get on the stand if he desired and to testify. He exercised his privilege against self-incrimination, his rights, and did not testify. But where is the actual prejudice here? You've got the two people bringing the allegations. You've got those people subject to cross-examination. You've got the defendant present and there to testify should he desire to do so, which we all recognize he didn't have to do. But was there really actual prejudice here?
Certainly there was. And the reason is that the focus, when you just focus, as the state has suggested, on what happened in the cottage in Fontana, Wisconsin, on those periods, or at those times, the focus is way too narrow, because our position is that nothing happened, he wasn't there. So to say that, well, Father McGuire could come in and say it didn't happen because I wasn't there, that doesn't mean a whole lot. What we need to defend against those kind of claims is to show that the complainants could not be telling the truth, not because somebody who was there disputes what they say, but because of other points show that they are just not being honest. For instance, much of the state's case was based on the allegations of sexual misconduct at Loyola Academy in Illinois, in Father McGuire's room on the third floor of the Jesuit residence hall. The three other Jesuits who lived in that residence hall and who could have testified and corroborated Dr. Ryan's testimony that the rooms were basically cardboard, that you could hear everything that happens inside these rooms, so therefore it's impossible that these complainants could actually be telling the truth that they were living for 20 or 200 to 250 days a year with Father McGuire, being involved in all kinds of activities in this room and nobody know about it. Those three witnesses, Father Renke, Father Beal, and Father Humbert, are all dead. The prejudice there is that we do not have the evidence, independent, unbiased evidence, to corroborate what the state presented or portrayed as the biased evidence of Dr. Ryan, who is, of course, Father McGuire's longtime friend, his longtime doctor. But we are left without corroboration for that testimony. So that's prejudice. We are left without, I'm sorry.
Please proceed.
We are left without the records. There was testimony, I think it was Father Aramond, testified that the Jesuits, in order to leave for any period of time, had to sign out, give permission to use the Jesuit cars. They had to sign out for the cars. The delay has resulted in all those records being destroyed. So we cannot prove through those records that at the times when the complainants say that my client traveled by those cars to Fontana to participate in these activities, that in fact he wasn't. He wasn't signed out. He didn't have a car. He wasn't getting up there. So to just focus on what happened in Fontana is far too narrow a focus. What we needed to focus on for the defense in this case is that, number one, these people are not being honest. Number two, that the evidence would have shown that Father McGuire simply was not there at the time that they said that these offenses were taking place.
Counsel, as I recall, the test is actual prejudice. I don't know what that means other than if you were prejudiced. Sometimes we see it written that way, but this, I recall, is actual prejudice, so it must mean, and we really mean it, you're prejudiced. Mm-hmm. And yet the examples that you give, the death of the Jesuits who also shared the third floor of the living quarters at Loyola Academy, Renke, Humbert, and Beale. You said the prejudice is we do not have independent, unbiased evidence to substantiate the defendant's version. Well, how do you know what their testimony would have been? And without knowing what their testimony would have been, how can you claim actual prejudice?
Okay. First of all, what is actual prejudice? My position is that actual prejudice means that it's not presumed prejudice. I don't believe that it has to go beyond and show specifically what these witnesses would have said. I would refer the court's attention to the Supreme Court of South Carolina in Brazel and also the Supreme Court just this last year of West Virginia in the Knotts case. The standard for actual prejudice that those courts recognize is that the defense was meaningfully impaired in his ability to defend against the state's charges to such an extent that the disposition of the criminal proceedings was likely affected. Yeah. And requiring that you look at things like the defense has to specifically identify the witnesses or the evidence that was lost, the specifics regarding what the expected content of the witness's testimony or the lost evidence would show, and serious attempts to locate, and also information that the information would not otherwise be available. Specifically addressing your question, we cannot know. If we knew exactly what those witnesses would testify to, then we probably wouldn't be prejudiced because there would be some other way to get that into evidence. In this case, the one person that we definitely know what they would have testified to is Renke, and that's because we have Exhibit 44, which is his written notes during the meeting concerning Sean.
Isn't your prejudice then? Inability to conduct a full investigation? Isn't your prejudice inability to know what they would have said? Isn't that your prejudice as opposed to we don't have independent, unbiased evidence to substantiate the defendants?
Well, that certainly is part of it, but I wouldn't limit it to that. For instance, with Renke, we know from his notes that Sean told him that the first time he left the state was just before Christmas of 1968, exactly the time when he testified at trial that he was in Fontana and with Father McGuire. The notes say that nothing happened. At trial, he testified that something did happen. We, by not having Father Renke, however, there to testify in person, The state was able to distort that into, we don't know what that really means. It actually corroborates the complainant's testimony. Without having Father Rehnke there to testify in person and be subject to cross-examination to verify those things, we're prejudiced. The other issue, I think, though, is when you're talking about the third floor. They didn't report anything. There is no evidence that those three reported anything as having been untoward on the third floor during those 250 days. Each of the complainants claimed that they were up there doing all these things with Father McGuire. If something had happened, you'd think they would have reported it. So there is at least some corroboration there that what they would testify to is not to corroborate the complaining witnesses, but to corroborate the defendant's assertions about what in fact happened, which was nothing.
Mr. Hennick, if we accept your argument on this point, doesn't the court have to withdraw language from Wilson or overrule Wilson?
Yes.
Okay. Just wanted that out in the open and quite clear.
Okay. Yes. And
okay, go ahead.
And I think to do so, even though there are other courts that hold consistent with Wilson, I think it would put this court consistent with, for instance, South Carolina and West Virginia, not courts that are known as being, you know, rampant pro-defendant courts, in what the real standard is. And we can get beyond having, set requirements or hurdles that have to be met at the beginning and focus on what is really important about due process, which is whether this particular defendant received a fair trial for or was denied a fair trial for whatever reason.
Well, and you know, it's an uphill battle to get a court to withdraw language or reverse itself because of the doctrines of stare decisis, quite properly. So you picked that as your oral argument, your main oral argument. What's your second best theory?
Second best theory is the application of the Privileges Immunities Clause bars application of the tolling provision in this case. And that is when we look at Scher and the standards in Scher, at least it's S-H-E-R, I assume that it's
right.
Pronounced Scher. We look first at whether the statute disadvantages non-residents. Scher, clearly it does. There's no dispute there. Second, whether the discrimination violates a fundamental right. And third, whether discrimination bears a substantial relation to a legitimate state objective.
So this argument really applies accepted Wisconsin law.
I'm sorry?
This argument, your privilege and immunity argument, applies.
Yes.
A Wisconsin case to this fact situation.
Yes, it is not necessary to overrule Scher to accept this argument. And the second issue there, the fundamental right in this case, we submit that the fundamental right that is being violated or at least infringed upon here is the right to present a full defense. And that there is no substantial relationship to a legitimate state interest. Because, as applied in this case, because it wasn't even reported until 35 years later. So therefore, the interest in identification of criminals, detection of crime, and apprehension of criminals that was identified in Scher simply is not in play in this case. And I see that my time has expired.
So. I have one other question to you. How old is your client now?
His late 70s, early 80s. I don't know exactly.
Probably about 79.
Yes.
The way I calculate it. And your client presently is in prison?
He is in federal prison, yes. He is serving a 25-year sentence in federal prison.
Okay, so let's just, for mathematical ease, call him 80. And his chances of getting out before 25 alive.
Yes.
Under federal rules, not high.
Under federal rules, you're entitled to approximately 16% good time off. So that's approximately 1/6 of the time. So that would be about 4 years. So it would be 21 years that you would have to serve.
Okay, 20. We'll round it out for 20. So if you figure he's 80 and you round it out at 20, he's 100.
Yes.
And this case was brought before the federal sentencing, right?
Yes.
What's the practical significance of this case on your client?
The practical significance of this case is exoneration.
Exoneration
from false allegations. Allegations that he consistently has stated were untrue, were false. I believe that there probably also are other impacts in federal prison when you have a detainer based on some other charges. Just the knowledge of knowing that the facts are there, that he is not guilty.
And the federal, what was the federal offense that he was convicted of?
The federal offense was, I believe, crossing state lines or possibly international lines for immoral purposes.
With a minor, male?
Yes, I think it was a 17-year-old. And that case is currently on appeal. And he currently is on appeal, and he currently is serving a sentence in the federal medical facility by Springfield, Missouri, due to his severe medical problems.
He's in a wheelchair now.
I don't recall whether he's in a wheelchair. He wasn't the last time that I saw him. However, his diabetes and heart and blood pressure and all of that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Representing the state is Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the court. As counsel's arguments wrapped up, it seemed less of a legal challenge based on the due process clause or a legal challenge to the statute of limitations, more an attempt to retry the case. That's been the point all along in this case, is that we're still attacking the victims in this case. That's really what this boils down to, that apparently these victims have been lying all along, even though at age 16 in 1969, Sean went to a trusted friend, a trusted priest, a Father Schlacks, who testified at trial and was subjected to cross-examination by defense, and told Father Schlacks, "I need to tell you something. Father McGuire touched me." "What do you mean he touched you?" "Well, he touched me." "You mean something of a sexual nature?" "Yes." "Okay, I'll do something about it." Father Schlacks did something about it. He told the school administrators, including Father Renke, who then called a meeting, and Father Renke's notes show at trial that that was true. That meeting did happen in 1969, and at that meeting, Sean told them that Father McGuire did untoward things, although it's not clear from Renke's notes how much detail it was. However, that meeting included Sean's father, even though Sean didn't want his father there. And that meeting included in school administrators who said they'd do something about it, and they did nothing. And it included, and then it ended, it resolved with Sean's father immediately taking him out of that school and sending him to another Catholic school. So if we want to retry the case, let's look at all the evidence. Let's look at the defense witnesses that were put on by Attorney Boyle, including Father Aramond, who talked about the layout of the building and how difficult it would have been to get children up to the third floor of the building.
Counselor, rather than getting into that, and I understand your position about, you know, this isn't the place to retry the case, and I am sympathetic to that. I'm very interested in your take on Lovasco. I asked opposing counsel a lot of questions about it, and my focus is on whether or not Lovasco really holds that it is not necessary to have untoward conduct by a prosecutor in order to have a due process violation. Could you talk about your take on Lovasco for me a little bit, please?
Well, I think the plain language of Lovasco requires a showing of untoward conduct, as you phrase it. And the proof is in the pudding, and that's in the Gouveia decision, which came down 7 years later after Lovasco. And it's also in the there's a decision, I think it's Ewing, or it's cited in at page 15 of our briefs, 1966 decision. And even counsel, in support of his argument, cites Brady v. Maryland, which is a case of prosecutor withholding exculpatory evidence from the defense. So these cases all focus on prosecutorial misconduct, on intentional delay and intended to gain a tactical advantage. So the Supreme Court has spoken with one voice on this in a series of decisions that span almost 20 years. And there is nothing to indicate, and this court in Wilson, and then most recently in MacArthur, has followed those cases to the letter, and there's no reason to change it. And it is consistent with due process analysis when it comes to state action. State action intended to deprive the defense of witnesses or of information, that you need the state action and you need to prove that there was an intent to gain a tactical advantage, and that's why you delay the proceedings. This court has done this, has engaged in the same analysis for decades in the juvenile law line of cases, where prosecutions were delayed to the point where the child became an adult. And this court engaged in the exact same analysis that it did in Wilson, that if the defense proves an intentional delay to gain a tactical advantage, then that delay could be a violation of due process if there's also proof of actual prejudice. And again, if you're going to overrule Wilson, then you also have to overrule paragraph 45 of the recent decision in MacArthur, of 2008 decision, which followed Wilson and rejected the very same argument being presented here. So I invite you to read the West Virginia case. I invite you to read the quite confusing Pennsylvania cases that we cited in our brief that run contrary to the vast weight of the authority on this, and in my view are directly contrary to the U.S. Supreme Court's lead on this, and that and you'll see that their analysis, in my view, is really a fiction. They're seeing something that's not there, that these Supreme Court cases do require a showing of intent to delay.
Did you have an opportunity to review Lefebvre on this issue? That is what Lovasco and Marion require and how states are coming down on its interpretation?
Right, and I did. And Lefebvre does a pretty good overview of where the courts are going on this. And I also would refer the court, there are Seventh Circuit cases where there's some confusion in the Seventh Circuit. And this all apparently arises out of a footnote in Lovasco where there's some concession by the government in that case. But again, that was 7 years before Govey, which continued to follow the intent to gain tactical advantage approach. So I just think people are reading a lot more into that than the Supreme Court even intended. And
there's the Wilson case, our Wilson case in Wisconsin, is consistent with the majority of states, the majority of jurisdictions' interpretation of Lovasco and Marion. Isn't that correct?
Yes, with the vast majority, and with most federal courts, and with this court's precedent, as I said, in other areas such as juvenile law.
But even without taking a close look at Lefebvre, it's clear that at least some jurisdictions don't read Lovasco and Marion the same way as the majority do. That is, the minority of jurisdictions.
Correct.
So there's room for interpretation.
And then in my view, there isn't, but obviously there is, based on those decisions. But and then they interpret it differently. There are some that say, well, a showing of reckless delay is sufficient. You don't have to show intentional. And then others say, well, as Mr. Hennick argued, you balance the prejudice against the reasons for the delay. I assume that if the reasons are good, the balance weighs more in favor of the state than if the reasons are bad. But I don't know. And I don't think those courts give us clear guidance. And I just think that, again, it's inconsistent with the way the United States Supreme Court has addressed this issue time and time again. And it is, after all, we're talking about fundamental fairness. We're talking about the state doing something to deprive the defendant of a fair trial. That's what this boils down to. You know, the state intentionally delayed something. The state withheld exculpatory evidence. The state deprived the person of a witness improperly. The state put on knowingly put on perjured testimony, things of that nature. That's what we're talking about. You have to show some intentional state action. I think this line of authority, Lovasco, Gouveia, in those cases are consistent with that approach. They require that kind of a showing because, after all, you're going to have, anytime you have a lengthy statute of limitations and you have some delay in charging, even though you are still within the statute of limitations, more times than not, witnesses are going to disappear. People will die. Documents will be destroyed. That happens. But as long as there's no intentional state misconduct, that you deal with that at trial. Those are credibility issues at trial. You point that out to the jury. You know, this witness could have been here, but he's dead. This witness we can't find because it's 20 years. Or, you know, those are jury issues. And it's only a pretrial issue when this defense can show that there was an intent to gain a tactical advantage and actual prejudice.
So what do you think Wilson says, and how does that apply in this case? One, you need actual prejudice, right?
You need actual prejudice and a showing of an intent to gain tactical advantage. And I think,
okay, now
not only that, and I refer this court not only to its own opinion in Wilson, but in the Seventh Circuit opinion on habeas, Wilson v. McCautry, where the opinion went on at length about not only the lack of showing of an intentional delay, but also the lack of proof of actual prejudice. And I think that decision is quite instructive on how this can be approached. And that's a published decision that's cited in our brief. I think it's something like 934 F.
Second. So here, and you need both, actual
yes.
prejudice and show. So here, where the government just was relying on a valid statute of limitations. You don't even have to look at actual prejudice according to the state's position.
Correct.
There's no evil intent, right?
Correct.
Therefore, this due process argument fails. You don't even have to look at whether it's fair or not. You don't even have to look at that. Is it your position, the state's position? Can't show an evil intent on the part of the state, therefore, no due process argument can make it.
Correct, because again, the statute of limitations generally serves to protect against stale prosecutions, and yet obviously the due process clause works within there. That in that rare case where there's either, or well, not so much rare anymore, but in the case where there is no statute of limitations or
murder.
A lengthy statute of limitations, the due process clause is a buffer, but that requires some showing of bad faith as well as actual prejudice, and a very detailed actual prejudice. And
so then you can't show bad faith. You got a statute of limitations, 40 years. I'm making that up. 40 years. Right? And the government, as soon as they find him and as soon as they can serve him, the government does that within the long statute of limitations on the 39th year. No bad faith, no evil. Due process argument on behalf of the defendant loses under Wilson. Is that right?
That's my view, yeah.
Okay. I just want to put it in as stark terms as I can.
And if there is government misconduct that comes to light after the trial, like if it turns out that they had knowingly put on perjured testimony or kidnapped the witness or something, and that comes to light, obviously you'll have a post-conviction challenge based on newly discovered evidence. Or
counsel, that would always be the case, regardless of when the case was tried. True?
Yes.
Perjured testimony.
Correct.
What about, I was waiting for you to address State v. Schur in your response to the previous question, and the holding there in regard to due process, that there is no fundamental right in regard to statutes of limitation. How does that fit in with your argument?
Well, you know, and I to be honest with you, I get a little confused when I try to address this, but it just seems to me it's undisputed that there's no fundamental right to a protection of a statute of limitations. And it seems to me that that fact alone forecloses any further analysis under Scheer. You don't have a fundamental right.
That's why I was wondering why you were getting into all these hypotheticals. It seems to be one of the main holdings in Scheer.
That's correct. I mean, counsel's conflating the due process with the statute of limitations. They're really two different things here. Do you have the protection of a statute of limitations? That's a statutory question. And the answer here is, yes, we have the protection of a statute of limitations here. It's fairly open-ended because he was not publicly a resident, but for many years. But so that ends that discussion. And the Privileges and Immunities Clause falls out then. There's no fundamental right, and so it matters not whether an Illinois resident would be treated differently from a Wisconsin resident, why not? That's a legislative prerogative. That's all that is. There's no constitutional issue there. He's trying to say, well, this ties into, the statute of limitations is not a fundamental right, but by extending the statute for the time he was not publicly a resident, therefore, it affects my fundamental right to due process and or to present a defense and or something else. I don't know. It doesn't work that way. The threshold issue is there a fundamental right to a statute of limitations? The answer is no. And so Scheer is still good law. And I would suggest that to adopt Mr. McGuire's position, you're also going to have to overrule Scheer when you overrule Wilson and MacArthur. And I don't think this court should do so because Scheer is a proper analysis and it's consistent with other jurisdictions that have faced the same issue. That, you know, when someone's not publicly a resident, it's fine to toll the statute of limitations even for 30 years because, as we know, as is often the case in cases involving sexual assaults of children and young teenagers, they wait many years to report them. That's consistent with the conduct of sexual assault victims, and that the victims should not be penalized because they finally got the courage to come forward 20 years later, 15 years later, or in this case, in Sean's case, even though he had the courage to come forward a year later, no one listened to him, so then he waited another 20 years to come forward. So I think, in my mind, you would have to overrule Scheer as well, because I think whether you call it an as-applied or a facial challenge. The facts of that case and the analysis seem to consider Scheer's claim from the perspective of, all right, he was not publicly a resident, but he also wasn't a fugitive. But that doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is there was a rational basis for this statute, and there's no fundamental right to a statute of limitations in the first place. And that's all that matters in the analysis.
But there is a fundamental right to a fair trial.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's where the due process analysis comes in, and then we get back to Wilson and Gouvet and Levasco and all those cases.
And I want to return to that. The first issue presented in the defendant's brief reads as follows. Whether the statute of limitations tolling provision for any time, now this deals with the statute, whether the statute of limitations tolling provision for any time when the defendant, quote, was not publicly a resident within the state, unquote, as applied to this case, violated either McGuire's right to equal protection and due process or the privileges and immunity clauses of the United States Constitution. Counsel, do you understand that first issue to be an as-applied issue?
I do. I mean, I think in my brief, I think I discussed that the way the court analyzed the issue in Scheer, it was an as-applied analysis. And the argument being, well, as applied to someone who was not a fugitive, you know, someone who you could have apprehended if you wanted to, if you knew that he had committed a crime. And I think Scheer is pretty clear that it really doesn't matter whether the person's a fugitive or publicly a resident of another state. The fact of the matter is that the legislature has made this determination that because of the rational basis and because, after all, the legislature doesn't even have to impose the statute of limitations at all, that we're going to apply it to all non-residents and to people who are residents who are in hiding.
But as applied, to me, is just shorthand for under the facts of this case.
Yeah, I think that's...
Do you agree? I mean, do you...
Right, and again, the facts of this case in Scher, other than the time involved, I think Scher was 8 years and this is 35 or 36, that the facts of Scher are similar in that he was also a non-resident who was not in hiding, and he brought that point. Okay.
I'm sorry. Yes. Please, you can...
No, and he made that point in his argument to this court, and this court said, well, yes, however... there's a rational basis for this statute, and you don't have a fundamental right to a statute of limitations in the first place. So
when I read your brief with regard to this issue, sometimes I thought you were addressing a facial challenge rather than an as-applied challenge. Now, of course...
Well, I suppose, I mean...
As applied under the facts of this case.
And maybe I don't understand the law well enough. I always thought facial challenges were more in the First Amendment context, where you challenge a statute that even though as applied to you, there's no constitutional problem, as applied to someone else, it violates his First Amendment rights. Therefore, across the board, the statute's unconstitutional. I'm not sure that facial challenges really work in this sort of a situation. I mean, I think, but you could interpret this as a facial challenge. In essence, he's saying the statute is improperly, the statute has to be thrown out entirely. The tolling provision has to be thrown out entirely, apparently, even if the person is a fugitive, because it could be applied to someone who's not a fugitive. Apparently.
I don't understand your comment that as applied challenges really focus on First Amendment.
Well, that's just...
We see as applied challenges.
Well, I know you see it all the time. I guess I just think it makes the most sense in that context where, you know, the First Amendment right is so valued and so powerful, and that when you create a statute that interferes with that right, even though it doesn't affect the particular defendant, the courts will generally throw out the statute.
Well, but you agree as applied challenges can pertain to all sorts of statutes and are not tied to First Amendment argument, don't you? Or do you think they all are tied, as applied is always tied to First Amendment?
I mean, I guess I don't. I guess I just don't know that area of the law that well. I mean, I've always thought that it was more in the nature of a First Amendment challenge, that you look at the facial challenges, that in other areas of the law, when you're dealing with other amendments to the Constitution, that you're generally more in the nature of as-applied challenges. But even if you are engaging in facial attacks on a statute, what you're saying is because it doesn't fit as to one person, you're throwing it out as to everyone else. So I guess if this is a facial challenge, then you have to throw out the statute even if it applies to fugitives.
So I guess. Let me just get the sum of your answer. Is the first issue that he presents, which addresses the statute of limitations and asserts that it is an as-applied challenge violating equal protection, due process, and the Privileges and Immunity Clause. Is it your position that it is, he's making an as-applied argument as he advocates, or is it your position that this is just a facial challenge even though he says it's as-applied? What's your position?
And I'm trying to recall what his argument. I guess it really doesn't matter. It seems to me the statute is constitutional either way, and this court has so held in Scher that it has a rational basis and there's no fundamental right involved. Therefore, the legislature pretty much can do what it wants in this area, and it's subject to, again, the due process limitations discussed earlier. So I don't know that it really matters that much, but as I argue that I believe he's making what he believes to be a facial challenge, and I'm saying no, he's making an as-applied challenge, and I'm saying, well, this court has already resolved that in Scher because that was, in my view, really an as-applied decision. So I guess that's, I guess where I'm at this point.
Mr. O'Brien, Mr. Hennig, sort of acknowledge that if he and Father McGuire prevail in this court, Father McGuire will still be in prison, but he would be, in effect, exonerated. What would be the effect on the law and on other people in prison if he were to prevail?
Well, I would imagine that Mr. MacArthur, for one, might file a motion for a new trial. I think anybody who, especially in sexual assault cases, where victims delayed reporting for some substantial period of time, might use this case to win a new trial. Homicide cases, I mean, counsel said, even in a homicide case. The Wilson case was a homicide case. That was why there was a 20-year, and there was a 20-year delay in bringing that charge. There was no statute of limitations at all. That it could open up a number of cases. I'm not sure how many, but it certainly would have an impact in the future. It would throw cold water on prosecutions where a victim did delay in coming forward, that a prosecutor would have to look very closely, even though the state did nothing wrong. Prosecutor would have to look and tell that victim, well, we might not be able to bring this because now there's a missing witness. You know, you waited 10 years and someone died. We can't go to trial because of State v. McGuire. So I guess I'd like to make one point, and again, I kind of hesitate to delve back into the facts of this case, but there was a real emphasis on missing records in counsel's arguments, and he talked about the records of when cars were taken out. And the priest who lived across the hall from Mr. McGuire was Father Renke, who was dead. And obviously, if he lived across the hall, he might know fairly closely what went on. He was also the principal of the school at the time. He was also at the meeting in 1969 with Sean, when Sean complained about Father McGuire's conduct at age 16. He was the one who wrote out the scribbled two-page notes that appear in Exhibit 44 in the record. He was also in charge of the records of the school. And there was a records custodian at trial, Mr. Brennan, who testified for the state, one of the last witnesses called by the state, who said he searched high and low. There were no records at all pertaining to Mr. McGuire in the school's offices. I would suggest that it would have been really beneficial to the state, not the defense, had Father Renke lived. And that ties in. And again, there's a line of authority in the Seventh Circuit dealing with this on the issue of actual prejudice, where you can't just show that a witness died or that a record is missing. You have to actually show that that witness would have been a witness for the defense, would have withstood cross-examination, and would have conceivably been deemed credible in the eyes of the jury. You have to make that kind of showing to show actual prejudice. You can't just say, well, someone died. These records are missing. We don't know when these cars were taken out. That doesn't matter, because when there's a delay like this, it harms the state, too. The state loses evidence that would have been quite valuable. And so you have to balance that. And again, that's why when reviewing a due process challenge where you are within the statute of limitations, you have to be very careful. You can't just say, well, this would be unfair. You know, if something really unfair happened, there are other avenues to challenge it. There are post-conviction remedies available. There are pretrial remedies. And of course, at trial, you can attack the credibility of witnesses, which, by the way, trial counsel did a stellar job of attacking the credibility of both victims in this case, as well as all of the other state's witnesses, and then put on a series of witnesses, including Dr. Ryan, who provided valuable defense testimony, Father Ehrman, who provided valuable defense testimony, another contemporary student who provided testimony supporting the defense theory that there might have been confusion and that this might have actually occurred in Eagle River, not Fontana, which supports their defense at trial, which was really a reasonable doubt defense rather than an I didn't do it defense. They're all of those things. So again, if in the due process analysis, you look at both whether the prosecutor engaged in misconduct, but also whether there really was actual prejudice, which the Seventh Circuit has referred to in exacting burden of proof. And so I would, again, ask this court not to overrule MacArthur, not to overrule Wilson, and not to overrule Scheer. And if there are no further questions, I'll conclude my argument.
Thank you. Are there any further questions, bench? Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Mr. Hennick, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Mr. Hennick, I have two questions for you about this case. The first is, besides the possibility of some hypothetical corroborating evidence, was there any direct evidence your client was deprived of presenting at trial as a result of the delay?
Well, first of all, I probably would dispute the suggestion that what I've already talked about is hypothetical.
Well, it's hypothetical that it would have fallen your client's way. It probably isn't disputed that there were actually records of some sort,
right,
or that the priest lived down the hall or whatever your claim is,
right,
in that regard. But in terms, it seems to me you've granted your client the benefit of every doubt as to what might have been testified about or might have been found in those records. But be that as it may, all of those things that you've hypothecated so far go to corroborating evidence. Is there any direct evidence that your client was deprived of presenting at trial?
Well, given that the defense in this case is that he did not do it, he was not there, it would be kind of difficult to figure out what would be direct evidence of that. The only thing that could be direct evidence is McGuire's own testimony, I didn't do it, or a statement by one of the complainants that admitting that they were lying. And we do have, for instance, the statement during the meeting with Renke and Sean, where according to Exhibit 44, Sean said that in the room nothing happened beyond back rubs. And in the same statement, that the first time he was out of state away from home was to Eagle River just before Christmas in 1968, and nothing happened. And that's exactly the time when he supposedly was in Fontana having all of these sexual contacts with Father McGuire. So we were denied Father Renke's testimony concerning that, and we were left with only a piece of paper that the prosecutor agreed to allow admission of, but specifically disputed the accuracy of. So that's what we were specifically denied.
The second question I have relates to the Scheer case.
Yes.
Can you help me understand how your argument in regard to equal protection and privileges and immunities squares with the holding in State v. Scheer?
Sure.
You may proceed, Mr. Hennick.
Scheer requires three things. One, discrimination against non-residents. Second, a fundamental violation of a fundamental right. Third, not a rational basis test, like the state keeps saying, but as this court said in Taylor v. Conta, a different standard that requires a legitimate state interest, but also that the means chosen shows a substantial connection to that legitimate interest. So remember, a rational basis just requires that there be a rational connection between the means chosen and the legitimate interest. As the court explained in Taylor v. Conta, here there has to be a much closer connection between the legitimate interest and the means chosen. So applying those three under Scheer, we know that the tolling provision and the statute of limitations does discriminate against non-residents, so that's met. The second one, as applied in this case, the fundamental right is the denial of a right to present a defense, or at least infringement of the right to present a defense, as applied here. In Scheer, the defendant,
seems to me you're kind of going away from the argument in regard to an as-applied test of the statute of limitations here, and you're going more to, as opposing counsel pointed out, the particulars of this particular case, because it seems to me that with the holding in Scheer, that the statute of limitations are not fundamental rights. I don't see it. It's unclear to me how you can pursue the as-applied challenge.
And the reason is because it's as applied as opposed to facially. In Scher, the extension because of tolling was only 2 years. The defendant in Scher did not allege any kind of prejudice resulting from that. The only thing that he could allege that was violated was his right to a statute of limitations. And this court in Scher held that that's not a fundamental right. You're out of the water there. The position here is that because of the 35-year delay, as applied here, the facts here, we were denied the right to present a defense. It's not just the statute of limitations. And the right to present a defense most certainly is a fundamental right. So even, you know, if we go back and look at Taylor v. Conta, where there's some question about whether the fundamental right requirement is actually there, it's not an argument I've made here, but even if the fundamental right is required, that's there where we are actually prejudiced and therefore have lost much of the right to present a defense. The third step, the substantial connection to a legitimate interest. Obviously, there are legitimate interests. Scher held that. And when you're looking at a facial challenge or one where there is no actual prejudice to the defendant, Scher controls. In this case, however, where the complainants did not even complain to the police until 35 years after, long after the six-year default statute of limitations had expired, those three interests of investigating the case, finding the perpetrator, getting them into court, those don't even apply here. They don't come into play. So there is no substantial, on the facts of this case, this specific case, there is no substantial connection between the interests and the means that were used.
And that's what brings the argument back to the deceased witnesses and the missing records.
Okay. Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hennick. Thank you, Counsel Hennick, and thank you, Counsel O'Brien, for your arguments in yet another criminal case to come before the court, another case involving the statute of limitations and sex offenses. And we appreciate your briefs as well as your argument. That concludes our hearing in 07-AP-2711-CR. State versus McGuire, and we'll take a brief recess so the students who wish to leave may do so, and that the students who are coming in for our second case may come into the chambers. We're in a brief recess.